If we as a society are going to affect the care and outcomes of the growing population, vastly growing population of Medicare recipients that we have, 55 million today, growing to 84 million in the next couple of decades, we have to think about long-term solutions. And so that's our work, to interrupt the chronic illness trajectory to get to long-term value.
For many healthcare professionals, Dr. Mary Naylor and her transitional care model, fondly referred to as the Naylor model, has become synonymous with care transitions and readmission prevention. Adopted by hundreds of hospitals nationwide, this program has shown significant improvement on rehospitalization rates and cost effectiveness. As a member of UPenn faculty for many years now, she also has served on MedPAC and for the National Academy of Medicine as a co-chair of one of their collaboratives. Often considered one of the leading experts on transitional care, Dr. Mary Naylor has provided many evidence-based approaches and solutions for hospital and health care organizations across the country. I hope you enjoy my conversation with her and this episode of Pop Health Podcast. We appreciate you following along with us and have a lot of other great episodes lined up for you through the rest of the year. Thanks again. Mary, thank you so much for sitting down with me today. I really appreciate it out here in Austin. As we like to do at the beginning of every episode, a lot of people know our guests from their professional achievements, but is there some sort of fun fact or something that people might not know about you?
Well, a few years ago, I was introduced to a very large audience as the grandmother of transitional care. And I'll never forget the face of the young gentleman who introduced me. He was a medical student at the time. Anyway, I told him that one of my favorite roles in life is that of a grandmother. And I spend much of any free time I have with two beautiful grandchildren, hopefully more to come.
Oh, excellent. So before we dive into kind of all of the transitional care and things that you're known for the most, you're a nurse by trade. How did you begin your career in nursing, and where did you begin your career in nursing?
So I went right out of high school to the Villanova University College of Nursing and worked a bit at a local hospital, and then went almost immediately into the master's program at the University of Pennsylvania. Had a very wonderful experience in both Villanova and Penn, spent a little time teaching at Thomas Jefferson University, and then had a great three-year fellowship studying health and social policy, which culminated in my working with the U.S. Senate Committee on Aging and Finance. And that is where my interest in both what nurses do to contribute to the care of older adults and public policy began.
Yeah, and you've continued to be involved in both since then. When you first began your career in nursing, did you know right away that you wanted to continue into academia and research and public policy, or did you think at first that you wanted to, you know, work in the emergency department or a med-surg and do more floor nursing?
Honestly, I had no idea what I wanted to do. Yeah. I ended up working in critical care, and my interest was in cardiovascular nursing, so I spent much of my early time in that area. But it wasn't until I had this fellowship that I began to think that there were opportunities, pretty substantial opportunities for nurses and all health team members in addressing what was then a huge challenge and today is an extraordinary opportunity.
Yeah. And you referenced UPenn. So you both went, you got your master's degree?
Master's in nursing and then subsequently a PhD. And when I finished the fellowship, so I worked part of as fellow and stayed on for a bit to work on the Hill, as they call it those days. And that's where I met a number of people back at my alma mater who had shared common interest in thinking about working with chronically ill older adults. And so the opportunity then presented itself to return. And I have been there, as some people say, for a long time.
And how does it feel to have gone from the student to now the professor and the research assistant? Do you like being on the other side of the coin there?
You know, it's sort of just been a journey. I am not sure that I certainly, when I first started and came back to Penn, I was still, I think, in my late 20s at the time, and came back in this role of associate dean. So I was watching these class of very young people come, thinking I was still very young. But over the years, all of a sudden, you look more like their parents, and now, unfortunately, more like their grandparents. So for me, it's just been a journey.
And can you tell me a little bit about your research team?
So I have been extraordinarily blessed. When I came to Penn, I was introduced within my first week to a group at the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics. Mark Pauley was then the executive director, and one of my great mentors, Claire Fagan, who was then dean of the School of Nursing, said to Mark, this is someone that is going to require a great deal of work, but I think she might make it. Mark and I have been working together. He is a world-class healthcare economist, and our team grew from there. We have fabulous scholars in nursing, in medicine, in social policy and practice, in healthcare economics. So we've been really fortunate to have that continuity.
Yeah. And do you find that you're just naturally drawn to research, because research has been a major part of your life now for so long? Do you enjoy the research aspect?
I love the research aspect, but what I think I really appreciate is the critical role of evidence to inform how we deliver care and to inform the policies. Right. So what my early experience did was to help me to understand how to frame questions that were extraordinarily significant, anticipated our future, and could be used in a way that really transformed care, health system delivery of care, as well as the policies needed to sustain that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you had mentioned some of your mentors. We're going to jump into your transitional care model in just a minute here. But one thing that I found really interesting when I was doing research for this episode is that your transitional care model actually evolved from a model that one of your other mentors and colleagues, Dorothy Dottie.
Dottie Bruton. Yes.
She had built caring for low birth weight infants.
That's right.
And so when you saw her model and what she was doing there, what about it triggered that you thought that that could also work with older adults?
Yeah. Well, Dottie and I had the great fortune to work together earlier at Thomas Jefferson University. So she was at Penn when I arrived, and you immediately need to kind of hone in on the research opportunity and questions you're going to be pursuing in that great university. So Dottie suggested to me that the transitional care model, of which she is the architect, could apply equally well to a vulnerable group of older adults. Dottie's work, which really focused on very low birth weight infants, at-risk pregnant moms, helped to uncover the issues of that population traveling from hospital to home. She had a landmark publication in the New England Journal of Medicine in the mid-80s, which was, at that time, for a nurse to be leading a multidisciplinary team, have that kind of publication, was pretty substantial. But the work itself was most important, because it helped to signal that we could take high-risk populations, in her case, very low birth weight infants, cut average length of stay, in her case, by 11 days, and enable their transition, the transitions of the babies, their moms and dads, home, where they wanted to be, and have equally, in some cases, better outcomes than the traditional care system. So the common ground of vulnerability was what intrigued us, both of us, right, and we began our journey together.
Right. And there are a lot of similarities just in healthcare. It seems like a lot of similar opportunities and challenges between, just like you said, those vulnerable age groups at both ends of the spectrum. So it's interesting that you were able to take that idea and mold it into what has become, obviously, the transitional care model, and something that has been far researched. So your model, the transitional care model, it relies on master's prepared advanced practice nurses. So first of all, can you tell me a little bit about why those advanced practice nurses are so important? And also, before you dive into it, just for the audience, can you explain what that means?
So an advanced practice nurse is minimally a master's prepared nurse, master's prepared in a clinical specialty. So they have master of science in nursing. And they, in our case, bring advanced knowledge and skills in the care of complex patient populations. Sure. That's their preparation. They become ideal then to think about how it is that they care for a population such as older adults living with extraordinarily complex health and social issues during the most vulnerable times of their lives, yeah, when they're encountering our very fragmented healthcare system. The way that we operationalize the model, it's an advanced practice nurse team-based model. We absolutely rely on the contributions of every team member, sure, social workers, physicians, whoever it is that can touch these individuals and help them throughout a very difficult journey. When we first started, these advanced practice nurses would work with patients in the hospital and follow them into the home. Increasingly, what we're doing is still that part of the journey, but continuing to follow these individuals for a much longer period of time, really moving toward population health.
Yeah.
The other part that of the work that we've been doing is to think about where are the other contexts in which high-risk older adults present themselves, and where are there opportunities to interrupt what for many is a downward trajectory, which manifests itself in people being hospitalized or having to go to the emergency room many, many times. And so our work has now moved into the community. We're working in primary care settings, co-managing high-risk older adults with physicians in the primary care context, but extending the wall of primary care to include the home,
right,
to include other sites of care. If patients are hospitalized, the nurses are able to follow them into the hospital and quickly bring them back home. We're equally looking and working in long-term care settings where many older adults are either in assisted living facilities, receiving services in their home or in nursing homes, equally at risk, and picking them up at that point in time to prevent avoidable adverse outcomes and high costly use of resources.
Yeah. It's just so interesting that you must have known at some point that it would all become so important. But it's just so interesting that you have been working on it for so long and only recently has it really come into the public mind frame of all of these things that you're talking about. Before we get too far ahead, can you give the audience the basic framework of the model?
Surely. So where we started, as I mentioned, was in that hospital to home transition.
Right.
And what we do is we screen people at the point that they enter the hospital to determine whether or not they would benefit from the kinds of services. Not everyone needs advanced practice nurse-led hospital-to-home transitions that is team-based. So we screen. If people screen as at high risk, that means that they, and many do, they have multiple health problems complicated by multiple social issues such right. as poverty. They have functional deficits or cognitive impairment complicating their health problems. They have inadequate family caregiver support. So we screen those at highest risk. If they're interested, enroll them. Immediately, then, an advanced practice nurse is deployed in the hospital within 24 hours of enrolling a patient. And that advanced practice nurse immediately begins to engage the patient, family caregivers, broadly defined, other team members, the nurses on the floor, the social workers, the discharge planners, case sure. managers, and all of the physicians involved, not just the one who brought them into the hospital or is serving them, but their primary care clinician, many of whom don't even know, they know a lot about the patient, but don't know the patient's hospitalized.
I think that that's a really interesting part of this, because I think that a lot of people don't know how much primary care physicians don't know about their own patients when they're hospitalized, even like you said, to the point that they might not even know that they were hospitalized.
Right.
And so bringing together the physician team can be challenging, but obviously it presents some really good opportunities there. There is a somewhat well-documented shortage of primary care physician and also a nursing shortage in a lot of places in the country. Has that had any effect on the ability to implement the model, or have you had to adjust at all?
Well, so unbundling what you just asked is a really big issue.
Right.
So on the primary care end, there is absolutely no question that we have a shortage of primary care physicians. And it is one of the places where advanced practice nurses are really increasingly being recognized as able to fill the gap in primary care delivery services.
Right.
So nurse practitioners in particular, we have seen a major growth in the number of nurse practitioners who are part of the primary care workforce solution.
Right.
Then you ask the question, do we have enough advanced practice nurses who can function in the transitional care role?
Yeah.
And across the country, we are producing through our master's programs and now our doctoral DNP programs, increasing numbers of advanced practice nurses who are positioned to be able to take on these very complex roles. There are geographic shortages, so
sure.
It's not even across the country, and we really need to pay attention in our workforce to make sure that we have adequate support. We do know that advanced practice nurses, nurse practitioners in particular, will be working in states increasingly where they have the capacity to really capitalize on all that they bring
right.
to the scope of practice. And I think the movement right now, as we're watching it, where all of the increasingly states are changing scope of practice regulations to allow for full practice at
right.
a scope at the top of the license, is better positioning us to have adequate workforce and geographically well dispersed. One point I did want to get to, because
yeah.
you asked in the beginning, was why master's prepared nurses,
mm-hmm.
why advanced practice nurses?
Right.
And it gets to the point you were asking about relationships. To be able to collaborate effectively with, for example, a group of physicians. So patients are being cared for by a host of specialists, primary care clinicians, and other team members. It requires both clinical savvy, capacity to be able to bring the clinical sophistication. So if I'm in someone's home 10 days after they have been discharged and watching changes in symptoms suggesting that they're decompensating and so on, the capacity to effectively collaborate with physicians is dependent on an understanding that you have the clinical skills to be able to manage that. The other set of skills that are central here are communication and collaboration skills. So to be able to get a disparate group of team members all on the same page
right.
with what Mr. Smith wants, the patients and their caregivers wants, is a very challenging, as you
right.
suggested, task. And so it's the advanced practice nurse who've been able to bring both the clinical and communication collaborative savvy that's essential to manage care across systems, across multiple providers.
Yeah. And that is actually, I'm glad you touched on that. I know that within the model, the nurses are the main maybe contact to in the patient's view. They're the
yeah.
one that they see the most consistently and they visit in the home.
Yeah.
Are they also the hub of that care team? Are they the one that kind of organizes the care team and shares the information between, or
yeah.
is there another member of the team that kind of manages that team?
Right. It may be giving you a little bit of a case example.
Yeah.
So a patient is enrolled, for example, traditionally, what we are known for is the hospital to home work.
Right.
So enrolled in the hospital, and the advanced practice nurse galvanizes everyone in the hospital, pharmacists to help think about, well, really, does Mr. Smith need to be on these 19 prescribed medications, and what can we do to simplify the plan? The social worker in the hospital to help think about the challenges, either behavioral health issues or social issues, housing, that might need to be addressed. But anyway, so galvanizes that team. That nurse who begins to work with Mr. Smith at hospital admission is in Mr. Smith's home within 24 hours of hospital
right.
discharge and continues to follow Mr. Smith, going to the first visit, to follow-up visit with a physician, whether that's primary care or specialist, to build the relationship with that clinician around co-management during the most intensive phase. At the end of what is an intensive phase, and it's an average of 2 months, but it could be 2 weeks, it could be 3 months, the nurse then figures out, uses a stratification to say what follow-up care is needed. And so some of these individuals might be able be quite stable after that period of time and be followed by their primary care clinician. Others might need community health workers or others who are touch points. And a third group might be those who are at very serious risk for poor outcomes and really are often the group that need palliative and, if their goals align, end-of-life care.
Right.
So we risk stratify again. The advanced practice nurse, though, is responsible for that population overall. So people don't stay in any one group. Some get better and don't need those services that, you know, they had, and others get worse and need quickly to have timely services implemented. So that's where the population health orientation is.
Right, right. And one thing that's really interesting to me about the model, and I realize this is going to be a large question, so we don't need to unpack it all the way,
yeah.
But so much of the focus is on 30 days post-discharge. Your model, it seems from the beginning, has been a longer time period than that.
Yeah.
Why did you immediately feel that a longer time period of visits by that nurse was important?
So this is really important because one part of this journey that I haven't described to you is that this model is rigorously evidence-based. We have had multiple randomized clinical trials funded by the National Institutes of Health, National Institute of Nursing Research. We've had comparative effectiveness studies comparing our work to other evidence-based and more recently rigorous translational efforts where we show we can replicate what we've learned in health systems and communities throughout the U.S. But you asked, why did we, you know, not stop at 30 days?
Right.
So our earliest randomized clinical trial targeting at that point cardiovascular, because I told you I knew a little bit about that, older adults with medical or surgical cardiovascular problems demonstrated, this is like, I certainly don't want to date myself, but we're talking a long time ago, demonstrated we could have impact immediately. That we, in that clinical trial, against standard care, had outcomes that extended well beyond 30 days. However, as we followed these patients, because we followed them longer than the intervention, we realized that the intervention wasn't sticking.
Right.
That they were reverting over a period of time back to what the standard or control group was, use of resource utilization was, and more importantly, their health outcomes, that they were starting to decline again. So our team immediately began to say, well, wait a minute, this isn't sticking. What do we need to do? And each of our subsequent clinical trials have been about getting to longer term impact. If we as a society are going to affect the care and outcomes of the growing population, vastly growing population of Medicare recipients that we have, 55 million today, growing to 84 million in the next couple of years, next couple of decades, I should say, we have to think about long-term solutions.
Sure.
And so that's our work then began to say, what is it that we could do not just to improve, and we should improve the care and experience in the short term, but to interrupt the chronic illness trajectory to get to long-term value. I believe that this aligns now with what systems need to be thinking about if they aren't already doing that.
Right.
A more population health orientation, an orientation that said we can't just be fixing gaps in services. We have to be using this opportunity with Mr. Smith to figure out how to change the path that enables him to get to better health, his caregiver to get to better management of the issues and lower stress, and our society to get to lower cost long term.
Yeah. And I'm sure that a lot of the listeners have experience with this in their, you know, day-to-day work that they do, but it's just such a challenging problem, opportunity to solve how to get the long-term effects to stick.
The movement toward value.
Yeah.
I think is central. And
right.
We've seen movement towards that. I mean, of course, now we have bundled payments, accountable care organizations. We have a already 30% of the Medicare population is cared is in managed care,
right,
where their orientation is not 30 days or 60 days, the payer's insurance orientation. It's long-term. So all of these signal, and health systems themselves are taking on increasing risk or shared risk. So all of these are really important signals that we've got to move away from a short-term value proposition to one that is good for the patient, most especially. We started this work not to get to 30-day readmissions. Honestly, that was a consequence, reducing 30-day readmission. That was a consequence of getting to better care.
Right.
But the continued investment in the patient around self-management, in the caregiver, in their capacity, in building the primary care support that many people never had, all of that has led us to realize that we can do better for people in a way that enables them to enjoy much higher quality of life for much longer term.
Absolutely. And you mentioned that it started with cardiac patients. Does your model now, does it work for all chronic illnesses, or do you still focus on a few specific diagnoses?
Great. We started with cardiac. That was our first, I think, by the time we had our second clinical trial, which was really trying to say, how could we improve care and outcomes, and now recognized how central the home care component was.
Right.
That focused on the top reasons for Medicare beneficiaries being hospitalized, both medical and surgical. Over time, we've expanded that to include now a group that has often been excluded from clinical trials, and that's older adults who have all of those health problems, but whose care is complicated by cognitive impairment, behavioral health issues, all of the factors and social issues that they have confronted. So we really have taken on the high-risk chronically ill, rising and high-risk chronically ill population.
Sure. And the clinical trials have been one part of it. You've also had your model implemented all over the country for quite some time now. Do you have any sort of idea of a number of places that have implemented your model and what some of the outcomes have been?
So first I want to, because I do also want to reflect, because I remember you earlier you said something about, well, you're watching it happen now. But honestly, we didn't watch it happen. We watched scaling of this. That was a tremendous amount and is a tremendous amount of our team's investment. About, I think we were three clinical trials in, and we were getting great publications and great publicity, largely because of the impact on rehospitalizations and total cost of care. And we're looking around our country and seeing that very few health systems or community had implemented the work. And so our team really took a very different path and decided that we were about having impact today in our lifetime, not only securing grants and getting great papers.
Sure.
And so we began to partner with health systems and with payers to see if we could replicate what we had learned in the clinical trials in the real world. And fortunately, despite huge numbers of barriers, legal, regulatory, it would take another podcast to walk through that, we prevailed, meaning we demonstrated you can get to better care using evidence and you can replicate the economic outcomes, not to the same extent that we demonstrate in the clinical trials, but in a compelling way to suggest that there's a return on investment in this orientation. Since that time, we've been working we then worked on figuring out how do you help systems to implement the model, and we had to have a number of spectacular failures to help us realize that systems need tools. So we have built a number of tools. We had to develop not just the high-risk screening, but scripts to help systems be able to make the case to patients and family caregivers. We have built web-based online seminars to help teams understand how to implement the model in their local context, performance improvement systems using root cause analysis, helping systems to know what metrics they should put in place to know that they're making progress. So all of those tools of translation had to be developed We couldn't just wrap it up in a bow as we thought in the beginning and send it 3,000 miles away. That work is now enabling systems, some of whom we work with very directly, meaning systems reach out to us and say, can you help prepare our staff? Can you come in and kind of help make the case to our chief financial officer and board and so on to do this? Can you help knit together the hospital community-based organizations, home care organizations, so we all function together in trying to make this happen? And we have numbers of examples of that. But what we really didn't know were the numbers of health systems throughout the country who were either adopting or adapting the transitional care model, using it alone or in combination with other evidence-based approaches. So last year, 2015-2016, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation funded a national survey of health and community-based systems that included hospice, included home care agencies, primary care agencies, and of the 582 distinct organizations that responded, 59% indicated that they had used the evidence from the transitional care model either to adopt adapted it, but as part of system redesign.
Wow, that's really incredible. And after so many years of development and, you know, modifications, as you had referenced, it has to feel good that it's making a difference. And also, it must be kind of interesting to have your idea, which transformed from another idea, then be transformed again to fit into health systems. But I think there's one thing that everybody I think probably knows is that no two health systems are the same,
right?
And they don't have the same challenges. And so it's interesting to see that people had taken the ideas behind it and run with it.
But one thing I want to, a caveat. So the systems with whom we've worked, we've been helping them and they've been sharing with us their performance.
Yeah.
The systems who've adapted the model, we have a great deal to learn from them, really to understand what adaptations did they make, and did those adaptations in staffing or in the system processes that they use, are they achieving the same outcomes? Are they getting to better reach, better outcomes? So our next part of our journey is to really systematically study what's happening in health systems that have adapted the transitional care model. A second part is that I still think it's way too slow. I mean, uptake of this work has really been happening, you know, one local health system at a time.
Sure.
And so we've been working with the Stevens Institute of Technology to develop a simulation that will enable decision makers to determine whether or not their health system would benefit from the implementation of the transitional care model. We just completed that simulation and now are embarking in actually testing it with payers and providers to see if we can move evidence much more quickly into health systems. There's a lot of noise out there, a lot of ideas that we get, receive calls every day from someone who has a new idea, a new technology, a new widget that they
yes.
think can make a big difference. And it's central that we understand which of them is working
right.
and which of them are not.
And I actually want to dive into the technology question with you. But before we get off of some of the partners that you do have, are you able to share some of the successes, either data or a success story from the partners that you're officially working with?
First of all, I should mention we've been working with the University of Pennsylvania Health System, who's been a major leader in our efforts to translate evidence into practice, have set up a transitional care service line, and our team constantly monitors performance, because that's how you get to survive in systems, by consistently demonstrating. And in that system, we've demonstrated very substantial gains in patients' experience with care, which is extraordinarily important, improved health outcomes, people better able to manage their systems, improved quality of life, and at the same time, reductions in all-cause rehospitalizations for a prolonged period of time. So that's one example. We have, what's exciting to me, though, is to see the ways in which the model's also being implemented in diverse systems. So Kentucky Blue Bluegrass has used this work to really focus on better improvement of community-based older adults. Now they've adapted it and made it their own. They're now working within, I think, 22 counties in Kentucky and 10 in West Virginia. So many systems, Yale New Haven, the leaders there have built a clinic, transitional care clinic, using the evidence from the model and its design, to enable older adults, or I should say not just older adults, but adults with heart failure to have this place, this transitional care place available to them, during a period of time post hospitalization, and have demonstrated tremendous impact. Trinitas, which is a hospital based in Elizabethtown, New Jersey, that serves a very impoverished community, has done amazing work with this model, including expanding the partnerships to include the food bank, community-based pharmacy, but really, you know, thinking about, as you suggest, how do we do this in a way that matches and aligns with the unique population we're serving, that capitalizes on our own organizational goals and values, and that embraces and builds upon this work to include the range of community-based partners that we need to, sure, if we're going to get to good outcomes.
Sure. You had mentioned you're getting pitched on technology all the time.
Right.
Technology is changing every aspect of our lives, it seems like, just about daily, but it's having an especially impactful moment in healthcare. Are there any technologies that you're particularly excited about, or how have you changed what you do and within the model to work with the way that technology is evolving?
So technology is central. I mean, I think it is a core element of successful programs. And we were very, in our early stages, I think I remember once we had to build essentially a patient health record because one did not exist. And I remember one of my children saying, well, that's a such and such 1.0. And I always thought 1.0 was good, but what she was suggesting was we had a long way to go. So we had a lot of workarounds that we used in early phases. Increasingly, our team has been attempting at local health system level, for example, within the University of Pennsylvania Health System, which has adopted Epic, to think about what are the core elements, data elements that need to be in a personal health record that are going to absolutely central to assure effective transitions from one level of care to another, from one setting to, sure, another. And then finally, I'd point to, we use telehealth,
yeah,
to make sure that we can continue to monitor successfully the care of people as they're making this journey. So you cannot rely on a person and a home visit to accomplish this alone. You need to embrace all of the opportunities, positioning people with their own records, the telehealth capacities that we currently have. And what I'm most excited about, though, is thinking about the future. So we had a conversation about a week ago with a colleague, former colleague of mine, who is involved in early work in translation, and who's talking about how the technologies of their company, which are holistic, they are very much focused on engagement. I mean, many of these older adults, because of their health needs and problems, are quite socially isolated.
Right.
So
right.
Their technology enables people to remain very socially connected. At the same time, it's doing the stuff that we think are important, providing the health alerts around medications and or the biometric market, you know, assessments. So I think that's where it is. We're going to have in the future consumer directed opportunities. Their technology, for example, enables caregivers who are geographically remote to really be part of the care and experience, all fully engaging the patient. This is not absent real participation and desire on the part of the patient for that. So The kind of consumer-directed work that's going on, integrated with the technologies that allow for health monitoring in the traditional sense, but push the boundaries around the things that people care about. We were watching videos of being streamed in on TV of grandchildren and great events in people's lives as a way of keeping them connected. So I think it's going to be all of that, the integration of technology into the plan of care, individualized for Mr. Smith or Mrs. Jones, is clearly our future in health.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you reference those companies or those type of companies, because one thing that we talk about with guests quite a bit on here is that healthcare hasn't quite caught up to the idea of developing technology that is actually good for patients or what the patients want. We're kind of in this cycle right now where a lot of technology for healthcare is being developed because it can and because it excites the people that are developing it, but it isn't necessarily engaging. So it's interesting to hear that there are some real world examples that you're seeing in the day-to-day that are engaging patients in a stronger and a more active way. You are speaking at the CMSA conference today. Like I had mentioned, we're here in Austin. I only have a couple of more minutes with you, and then I need to let you go and give your keynote address. But I did want to ask you a little bit about it, and forgive me if I butcher the title of your talk, but it's Transforming the Course, Enhancing the Patient Care Team for Optimal Transitions in Care. So you're going to be addressing an audience of case managers. First of all, what will your talk entail, and what do you hope that they take from your talk today?
Well, I think the Case Management Society is a gathering of people that are transforming the course.
Right.
I mean, they are individuals that are involved in exactly the kind of work that I'm describing, following people, the people who are counting on them. Patients and family caregivers on their journey and enabling, positioning them to have the best outcomes. And what I love about the messaging of this organization and that which I hope to reinforce in the talk today is that we're there, to be with patients and to be there for them.
Right.
And that requires us to really rethink our relationships with patients and family caregivers, that they, we use language all the time, patient engagement, partnership with patients. Our team has learned that is extraordinarily challenging.
Right.
It's challenging for individuals, and it's challenging to get an entire healthcare team to wrap their heads around that we're there because patients have goals, aspirations, desires, and we need to both uncover what they are as well as really walk the walk with them. So this notion of patient engagement and how what we've learned in our work is a central part of what I hope to communicate and how it's not easy and it's not language. And it needs to become more of part of our culture of care. The second is that, we have a shared accountability. So all of us, all team members, really need to think about how they capitalize on the gifts of each other in a respectful way to do what is important on behalf of patients and family caregivers. And so this notion of team, again, language we use all the time, we have to work in teams, we have to function as teams, is really something I think that at least our healthcare system, we still have a long way to go to really make sure that we position each team member to optimally function, help them grow and feel valued and respected, and that is shared, that accountability for patients' outcomes and family caregivers' outcomes is shared. And finally, I think this message of advocacy. So we work with people and we work for them. My work and in health policy and in sitting on the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission,
right,
and now on the National Academy of Medicine, co-chairing a collaborative around changing the culture of health, is about that advocacy role, that we have opportunities beyond our caregiving roles that we need to capitalize on. We need to be the voice. We need to make sure the patient's voice is in the design of everything we do. But when they can't be there, we need to be their voice.
Yeah. And I'm really glad that you touched on that, because that's one thing that unfortunately we didn't get to touch on too much today. But you work with the National Academy of Medicine. You had referenced the collaborative that you co-chair. Also that you served on MedPAC. What was the term for MedPAC?
So it's a six-year term, and I finished, I think, last April.
Yeah. And then also one thing that I find very interesting is that you are also part of the RAND
yes.
The research
organization. So I'm part of the RAND Health Advisory Group, right. And I'm on AHRQ's National Advisory Council. And so what do they have in common? They are all environments that really are about building evidence to change health, to change people's health outcomes, not healthcare outcomes,
yeah.
But their health outcomes, and to do this in a way that is making the wisest use of increasingly finite resources. And so I have been blessed to be a part of groups such as MedPAC, who are recommending policies related to payment of care, or ARCS, National Advisory Council, who are thinking about ways to implement evidence in health systems and communities, or RAND's Health Advisory Group, which is this exquisite group of health researchers who are also very much committed to having impact. So these are all environments, and this culture of care where we collaborative, where we bring patients and family caregivers into the collaborative, central role, along with health system leaders and policymakers, so that they're all having a conversation about what it is that we need to do together to change our culture of care.
Yeah. And just last thing here before I wrap up, and thank you so much for sitting down with me. But for those of us that aren't involved on the public policy side, what is something that you learned about being involved in creating a public policy and the debate and discussion that goes along there that you weren't expecting maybe when you went into it?
Well, first of all, when I had my initial exposure, and that was when I was a W.K. Kellogg Fellow, it was a very different era.
Sure.
But the thing that I would say is most important is that I've learned, and now as I head the New Cortland Center for Transitions in Health at Penn School of Nursing, the most extraordinary group, if I might say, of researchers from all different disciplines, including we bring in pre-docs and post-docs, so the next generation who are all focused on developing evidence and using it to have impact. So that's the work of our center. The thing that public policy taught me that I try to instill in them is make sure that you frame your question in the most, to have the most significant impact. Too often we think about questions narrowly, issues narrowly, thinking about, you know, what is it that case managers can do? But really, the questions need to be framed in the context of what is it that people need, patients need, family caregivers need. And when you frame it in the broader context, then case managers will come to rise because right. They're central right. To the solution.
Right. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for sitting down with me. It really was a pleasure today.
Thank you so much, Zach, for this opportunity.
Pop Health Podcast is a public service of 24-Hour Home Care.